For me, it is completely foreign.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for standing by, and welcome to tonight's First Rule of Successful Investing Setting Goals conference call. At this time, all parties are in listen-only mode. After the presentation, a question-and-answer session will be conducted at the moderator's discretion. At that time, if you would like to ask a question or make a comment, please press 7 on your telephone keypad. For participants using speaker equipment, it is recommended that you pick up your handset before pressing the 7 key. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Alicia Barron.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Alicia Barron. I'm the manager of client programs and services with the Lone Star Chapter, and I'm sure you've gotten plenty of obnoxious emails from me. I just wanted to welcome you all to the conference and say that I think this is a fantastic step to your future, and I'm really pleased to have Hal Lind joining us from Morgan Keegan. So I'm going to turn it over to him and let him tell you a little bit about himself and then get straight into the presentation.
Thank you, Alicia. My name is Hal Lind. I'm a managing director at Morgan Keegan. I work within the Lind Group. It's a group of individuals that works with both individual investors and institutional investors like banks and insurance companies and large endowments on, first of all, putting together what their goals and investment objectives are, and then also putting together a plan to help them reach those objectives. So not something that's dissimilar to what we're actually talking about today. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and go right into the presentation. I'm making the assumption that you're online and you're following along with the presentation. We're going to discuss the basics of investment planning and why your goals are the cornerstone to any investment plan. And I mean any. Whenever you invest $1, you should have your goals laid out. Now, the presentation is not going to only explain why goals are important, but we're also going to discuss a few places where you can get some help in the process. So in the end, it's my hope that you're going to be able to set some goals where they would apply to investing. So I'm going to start out by posing a question. That is, does goal setting work? Now, just like a professional pollster, we can influence that income or response by just asking a specific group of people. Perhaps we could ask like a group of retired folks or a class of elementary students about goals and predict the income. But we're going to start off by asking this question to a group of Harvard graduates. And if I can change these slides, there we go. This is actually from a book. It's called What They Don't Teach You in the Harvard Business School by Mark McCormick. He talks about a study that's conducted on the students in the 1979 Harvard MBA program. And in that year, the students were asked, have you set clear written goals for your future and made plans to accomplish them? Now, as you can imagine, the responses would vary. Only 3% of the entire graduating class both had written down goals and plans, whereas 13% had goals, but nothing specifically was in writing, and a whopping 84% had no specific goals at all. Now, 10 years later, we go ahead and look at the accomplishments. In this graduating class, you know, while these results were somewhat predictable, still pretty astonishing. The 13% of the class that had no goals were earning on the average twice as much as those folks who didn't have their goals written down at all. That's the 84%. But what's astounding by this is that the 3% that had both their goals written down and the processes on how they were going to accomplish them had 10 times the income of the entire other 97% put together. Sometimes philosophers are able to say things or explain the way that things work in a way that, you know, just regular people like us can understand them better. For the question about setting goals, I've turned to the baseball legend, Yogi Berra, who made a few famous sayings. And one of them you probably remember is, it ain't over until it's over, or when you get to the fork in the road, take it. Well, he had said something about investing I'm sure by coincidence or by accidents, but it's so true. He says, if you don't know where you're going, you're going to wind up where you're somewhere else. And it couldn't be any more true when it comes to investing. People ask me all the time if investment A is good or investment B is good, something they perhaps saw on TV or read in the newspaper. And my answer is always the same, and that is it really depends. If it really it depends on your goals. If it has something to do with what you're trying to accomplish, then it could either be a good or bad investment for that particular reason. But just like Yogi Berra said, if you don't know why you're going, know where you're going, you're going to wind up somewhere else. Now, turning to the regulatory agencies, there's one that everyone in the brokerage community has to toe the line to. It's called FINRA. FINRA is the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which is the largest independent regulator for all securities firms doing business in the United States. That's 4,900 brokerage firms, 173,000 branch offices, and approximately 651,000 registered security representatives. Now, this was created in 2007, that's FINRA, through the consolidation of the National Association of Securities Dealers and all other member regulation and enforcement functions of the New York Stock Exchange. So the reason I'm bringing this up here today is let's take a look at what the largest regulatory agency in the investment world has to say, basically, about setting goals. Most people invest to achieve specific financial goals. Some of these goals are widely shared. Now, for example, many people want to own their own home, maybe send their children or grandchildren to college. You know, there's almost a universal desire across the board as well to retire comfortably with the reasonable expectation that you're going to have adequate income for as long as you need it. So that's kind of a goal that maybe investors have that could be universal across the board. But before undertaking any investment program, FINRA says it's critical that you assess your current situation and form goals. So this is coming right from the top. You're going to need to take an accurate account of what you have as far as assets. You have to take into account what you have as far as liabilities, like bills. Then they also talk about your age, okay? What your goals are, what you want to accomplish by investing. They say, then let's take a look at your time frame for various goals, your attitude towards risk, called risk tolerance, and we're going to go into these things in detail in a moment. You should also understand the ideas about asset allocation and diversification. They say only then should you consider what your investment choices are and how the different types of investments are going to work for you. Now, if you take a look at this particular slide, there's not a whole lot of fluctuation you have in any situation that you might be currently facing where you're considering investing. In other words, we can't change our age, okay? We may have some sort of attitude towards risk that we can, you know, change over time, but everything pretty much goes back to your goals. You have to have goals before it even makes sense to invest dollar one. So that's coming right from FINRA. Setting your investment goals now involves a process. So let's take a look at this. It's a process that involves a time horizon, your risk tolerance, liquidity needs, and then we start off by matching your investments to your goals. That's really the last step, whereas you can go from goal setting to actually investing. Now, looking at these one at a time, let's take a look at time horizon. What is my time horizon? For example, do I need my investments to grow so I can buy a house? The time horizon then would be the period of time to make that initial down payment. Okay, if I need, for example, to save up for my child's college, if we're starting at the time of their birth, maybe you have some time, you know, depending on if you've birthed a genius or not, maybe you have as many as 17 or 18 years, or even shorter if you started later. Next is not only what when is my time horizon, the question looks about the same, but when will I need my money? Some time horizons can actually mean that you need money over a long period of time. So our time horizon may be 5, 10, or 15 years, but I may only need the money over a portion of that time, or in some cases, like in retirement, all of that time. Next, will I need the money sooner or later? In other words, does your plan need to be flexible? As far as our goals are concerned, that goes back to the point that we're going to make at the end of this presentation, and that is goals are meant to be addressed and readdressed and readdressed at each point of review. Your point of review can be different than anybody else's. Some folks need to take a look at their plan and their goals on a quarterly or monthly basis. Some take much more time in between than that. Next, is my time horizon specific or general? Going back to that long period of time, okay, as in, am I going to take money in a one-time shot, or am I going to take the money out over a long period of time, is how close can you specify it? In other words, the more specific you can be about your goals, the better that you can line those goals up with the actual investments in a portfolio. Next would be risk tolerance. That's a part of opening an account at any brokerage firm. And the question is, what really does risk tolerance mean? And we try to, equate that into words, and it's really a little bit different for everybody. First one is, what is my ability to handle losses emotionally? So I guess if I told you that, I lost $1,000, that would be all relative to maybe I had $10 million invested. $1,000 would be not much of a, let's say, a daily move in the investment world. But if it was my only $1,000 in the world, it could be emotionally, pretty tough. So what is my ability to handle losses emotionally? What is my ability to make up losses within my time frame? Now, we talked just a second ago about the length of our time frame. Is it short? Is it long? Is it specified? Or is it general? If you don't have a real defined timeline on when you will need money, then your ability to make up losses within a time frame becomes very relevant. If it's a shorter amount of time, it's a lot harder to make up versus a longer period of time. If I know how long I have versus not how long I have, you really don't need to be venturing into areas where you could be taking much loss. So that's pretty important. What kind of access do I need to my money? In other words, if we have a five-year time horizon before we think we're going to start spending money, but you never know. You never know. Something may come up, and I may need access to it sooner. What kind of penalties are you going to have to take is one consideration. Another one is you don't really want to be taking money out of an investment portfolio at the time of at the same time you're taking any kind of losses. That's like getting 50 cents perhaps on every dollar that you're spending, which money doesn't last long enough as it is. If you're spending discounted dollars, you can use it up a lot quicker. Liquidity needs, we're also going to be addressing in the next slide. And next is, how much investment experience do I have? Well, let's relate all these things back up to risk tolerance, and that is, what is my ability to handle losses both emotionally and make up losses within a specific time frame? What kind of access do I need? Am I going to be needing it sooner or later? Am I going to be taking penalties? And then experience, the way that plays into everything as far as risk tolerance goes, is if you've been there before, you pretty much know what to expect. Now, I'm not saying that if you have been in the market a long time, you know what to expect tomorrow as far as the market going up or down, but emotionally and as far as your plan goes, you would have experience knowing that over time, if you're properly allocated and you're paying attention to your investments, over history, they have come back. So experience does play into the risk tolerance equation. Now, we talked about liquidity needs a second ago. I'm just going to go into it a little bit more. The dictionary says liquidity means capable of covering current liabilities quickly with current assets. Now, let's just replace the word current with cash. So if I have a cash liability, in other words, I need to spend money today, I need to probably use cash instead of credit, if you will, in order to handle that expense. The reason I say cash instead of credit is a form of liquidity, but we're not talking about debt. We're actually talking about these investable dollars that would be used to cover some particular goal that we're trying to achieve in the future. So when we're talking about our investments and liquidity, capable of covering current liabilities quickly with current assets. So as it's time to spend money, how liquid is our money? Do I have access to my money when I need it? Will there be a cost to making a withdrawal? And will I need to sell investments at a loss? So liquidity needs are certainly a huge factor in our goal setting. Now, once you've determined what your time horizon is, your risk tolerance, liquidity needs, the final step is to match your investments with your actual investment goals. Now, these can range from those, you know, generally that are considered safe, like treasury bills and money market mutual funds, to something risky like commodity futures and venture capital deals. There's literally thousands of different investment vehicles, but just remember this. In general, the safer the investment, which means the less risk of loss, then the less potential for future gain. And the flip side of that is the riskier the investment, the greater potential for gain, but then also the greater potential for loss. So when we're matching our investments to our goals, and this is working a little bit backwards, remember, because first we're defining what our goals are, it's going to help then when we look at our goals to define what our cash flow needs will be. And I know that's not easy to do every time, but you need to start with where you are today. What are our cash flow needs today, and then project them into the future? You start off by an asset liability evaluation. Pretty much taking a look at our pool of assets, whatever they may be, and our obligations, be it some, you know, paying off debt or something you see coming in the future, and just having that balance or balance sheet out, if you will, so that you can make the appropriate assumptions on your investments. Your estate plan is a critical part of matching your goals to your investments, insurance planning, and tax planning. Now, when it comes to investing, there's a definite relationship between risk and return. Now, I'm going to take this is a little bit of a sidestep here that goes away from goals, but just to make that a little bit easier to understand, when we say matching investments to goals, well, what does that mean? Well, what I put here was a slide basically of just some different types of investments where along the bottom of the chart says risk. So the further out we go to the right, the greater the risk. And the potential return is on the left-hand side, and obviously the higher we go there, the greater potential for return. So I'm going to attempt to use my pointer here. So as you can see here with where the treasury bills are, we're looking at the least amount of risk, okay, from the bottom side here, but also the least potential return. The flip side of that, options and futures, common stock, preferred stock, well, the higher the risk, the higher potential for the return. Okay, so basically what we're trying to do is we're balancing that stability, growth, and income trade-off to wherever our goals are. And said simply or more clearly is we don't want to be taking any more risk than we actually need to achieve stability, growth, and income. So kind of going backwards, that is the whole reason for putting our goals on paper. So the next step would be your asset allocation considerations. The reason that we're going into this, once again, is so you can see how goal setting is going to affect all of your decisions going into the future, okay? So the factors on asset allocation considerations is diversification, your risk tolerance, the time frame, we've gone through a few of these already, your personal financial situation, and more very important here are your liquidity needs. No real comment about putting your eggs all in one basket, but I think it tells the whole story here. Asset allocation basically is not putting all of your eggs in one basket, but deciding what you're going to do as far as asset allocation. You have to go through these lists of factors first. And we've gone through a few of these things, in which are all included in coming up with what your investment goals are. So with that, asset allocations, you would next take that into to three basic areas. And now, like we said in the beginning, this is really different for everybody. But just as a quick example, one thing you would do in an asset allocation is to be very conservative. An asset allocation that's conservative is going to really be focused on preserving principal. You can see that the bottom part of this pie chart here is all bonds. That's if we went back a couple of slides, that's on the lower risk and lower return. We're looking for stability. Cash alternatives, obviously these are at the highest safety area in that chart, and then stocks. So we're taking very little risk, okay, in the conservative model. A model that would be more moderate is going to do a little bit more balancing between stocks and bonds. So you have a higher portion of bonds versus, a higher portion of stocks versus bonds, and you still have a cash alternative. And then this is where most of us shouldn't be, but a lot of us usually are, and that's the aggressive allocation. An aggressive allocation is going to be very heavily stock-oriented. And when I use the term stocks, I'm talking about anything about stocks and with stocks inside them, like a stock mutual fund. So getting back to the first rule of successful investing, setting goals, to review this, we've got our time horizon, risk tolerance, liquidity needs, and then we're matching our goals to investments. Is this true? Okay. I've been told that not everybody is actually on the slide, so I apologize if I've gone over a couple of things that I just assumed that you were looking at a slide. But the point I want to make is the time horizon, the risk tolerance, your liquidity needs, and then matching investments to goals doesn't stop there. It's review, review, review. In other words, we need to constantly be looking at what our goals are, what our risk tolerance is. Remember what our risk tolerance questions were that had to do with the ability to make up a loss? Well, if our time horizon is now shortening because of time, our risk tolerance is also changing over time. So is our liquidity needs, and so then our matching investments to goals. So this is a very fluid equation that needs to be reviewed, then it needs to be reviewed and reviewed. Now, we always end with this particular slide. It's the role of the financial professional. We've made ourselves here at Morgan Keegan available at no charge to the folks over at Lone Star. Let me tell you what a professional does. They help determine what your investment goals are, your timelines, and risk tolerance. Not just here at Morgan Keegan, but anybody that you talk to should be sitting down and talking about these three specific things. If you can sit down with them and beforehand give them a list of what your goals are, you should have a much more productive relationship. A professional will also help you create that asset allocation model and select those specific investments to help you actually reach those goals, and then finally manage, monitor, and modify your portfolio. So just to recap, the first part of investing, and I guess I could also call this little presentation the second part and the third and last part of investing, all has to do with goal setting. Without goals, when you talk about investing, you're merely speculating. And I challenge anybody to tell me that if they're saving for retirement, a house, or just a certain type of lifestyle, if they don't have any goals written down and dollar one goes into the stock market or any type of investment, then it's more speculation than any plan. So we're going to open it up to some questions and answers. And our moderator, I think Tom ought to be picking up here, giving us instructions to move forward.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone that if you would like to ask a question, please press 7 on your telephone keypad. Once again, I would like to remind everyone that if you would like to ask a question, please press 7 on your telephone keypad.
Tom, I'm going to interrupt here because I did have a question to start with. This is Alicia.
Okay, go ahead.
I was just curious, Hal, if you know, is there a minimum amount of money that one should have before they really start investing?
That's a good question. Just to repeat that, is there a minimum amount of money I need before I start investing? And if we go back to the name of our workshop here, and that is, you know, the first thing in for successful investing is goal setting. It doesn't matter if you have $1 or $10 million. The very first step is to set those goals. So the answer to your question is yes. You can start investing with as little as maybe $100 in many situations. But even before you invest $100, not to have your goals written down with a plan on how you're going to achieve those goals, once again, is merely speculating. So if I'm investing $100, for example, and my goal is to buy a house, to buy that house, I need $10,000 of down payment. If I don't have a specific plan to either add more money or have a very long time horizon, then as you can imagine in that scenario, it is just speculation. So once again, that goal setting is that cornerstone of your plan. If you're a person just either starting out, a person that's, you know, looking for some new answers down the road, or if you've been around the block, you've been investing for tens of years through a retirement plan or some other way, you need to go back to the basics. Look at your goals. Look at, again, what your entire situation is to help you determine what your risk tolerance is, also your time horizons. Reevaluate those goals and then look at your portfolio again.
Okay. Thank you.
Hey, I'm showing that we have our next question. Comes from Paula.
Hi. Well, my question is, if you are already in your retirement plan with a 401k and you have an X amount of dollars that have accumulated there, what is your opinion on whether or not you should use that money in terms of loans to pay off high interest accounts or credit cards or debt? What is your opinion on that?
Thanks for the question, Paula. And just to rephrase that, if you have if you're involved in a retirement plan at your place of employment, like a 401k, is a good example of that. And you need some money to pay off other debt, or something else, whatever it may be. Is it a good idea to take money out of that retirement plan? And the answer is going to vary a little bit depending on different situations. Let me give you a couple of them right now. If you have a high interest rate debt and it's going to be paid off over a long period of time. Remember, when you're taking money out of a 401k, you're actually borrowing that money from yourself. So your company is then going to require you to take money out of your paycheck to repay that debt. And at some point in time, if not immediately, it varies from plan to plan. But also included in there is going to be some interest rate. As small as it may be, you will be paying some rate on those dollars. And by the way, all of that goes back to you. So it's hard to say if it's proper to take money out in any particular situation. I'd have to see what it was individually, but it is okay. Now, the clarification here on the second example is if it's not a 401k, it's an IRA. So you're not inside your company plan. You're investing dollars that the government allow, or the tax guys allow you to do outside of your plan. You really can't borrow. Once you take money out of one of those plans, as a brokerage firm, we're required to tell the IRS that you've taken money out of a retirement plan. Whereas if I'm running the 401k at the company that you work at, and you borrow money out of there, I don't have to tell Uncle Sam. So the difference being is if you take money out of an IRA, not your 401k, I'm going to tell the government that you've taken, or I'm going to tell the tax people that you've taken money out. You may have the ability to put some of that back in, and I'm not a tax advisor. I'm not allowed to give tax advice, so that's between you and your tax advisor. But in most cases, you're going to end up not only paying income tax on those dollars, but also pay a 10% penalty. So I would say in a lot of cases, if it's a 401k and you have a high interest rate loan and you intend to pay your 401k money back, remember, once you take money out of your plan and you don't put it back in, there won't be any other opportunities to invest those dollars that are tax-free. In other words, if you leave that place of employment, you won't have the ability to put those tax-free dollars back to work. So if you had a plan to pay yourself back, then absolutely pay off those high interest rate debts. But remember, there's nothing magic here. There's only so many dollars that you have to your disposal. They just don't appear. So if you take money out, your plan has to be to put them back in. And the difference is going to be what you're paying on that high interest loan and the interest that you're paying yourself back. And if you can pay yourself back, then it's usually a good idea.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Paula.
Okay. And I am showing at the moment there are no other questions.
I actually have another question, Tom, so I'm going to interject here. I was just curious if there is a better option for somebody who wants to invest but would like to have quick access to their money. So if they wanted to invest but maybe were a little squeamish and wanted to be able to take it out quickly, or if there was something to come up that they would then need to pull that money out again, is there a better option for them?
So that's a good question, Alicia, and that really goes back to liquidity. So the question is, if I'm a little uncertain about wanting access or not having access to my money, she used the word squirmish, but it could be any kind of word, and that squirmish kind of goes back to now thinking about risk tolerance. Okay, the more squirmish you are, maybe the lower your risk tolerance, the less risk you should be taking. And remember, risk when we're talking about investments is your ability to lose. Obviously, it's your ability to gain. But when we talk about risk in the sense of investing, we're really looking at the potential percentage of loss. So if I'm a little bit squirmish about wanting access to my money, then we really want to take a look at things to where we'll always have access to our money. So you can have a plan that does virtually the same thing as plan A versus plan B. One, you can have more access to your money than the other. But if that were the case, we'd expect a higher return from the plan where we had less access. So the more access, I guess here's the end of the question, the end of the answer, and that is the more access that you require to your money, be it in just liquidity form or just being able to write a check on it when you need it or just any time outside of a planned check time, the lower your expected return would be. All kind of goes back to that goal setting again, because if we know we need to make a certain amount of money over a certain period of time, once again, we want to take the least risk that we can in order to achieve that. Some investment vehicles may offer that higher return to get you to a particular goal, but it may take away some of that liquidity, some of your access to that money. One example of that could be an annuity. Several folks will go into an annuity, and those are offered by insurance companies, and that an annuity is just a guarantee from that company to pay you back over a certain period of time at some kind of stated return. That return can be an exact return, like 6-7%, or it can be a return that's connected to an index, like a stock market or some sort of investment return on another instrument that they provide. So that would be a case where you have lower liquidity or lower access to your money. Perhaps with that same goal of needing a particular return over same period of time, you couldn't get on a very certain basis. Let's say you needed 6% over the next 10 years. You know, the last 10 years, the Dow Jones hasn't given us 10%. I mean, 6%. So depending on what your time horizon is and what your return needs are, you may have to go into some products in order to achieve those goals that gives you less liquidity. And I'm sorry if that got a little bit confusing, but I feel like that access to money and liquidity are two of the most, or is probably the one most misunderstood concept when folks are first starting out. And it's not because it's a bad or a good investment. It's that if you are expecting more, then you have to usually give up something more. And in this case, we're talking about just access to your cash.
Great. Thank you.
And I'm showing we have our next question. It comes from Paula.
Okay. One more question to sort of ask on investments and goals. We have heard a lot of conversation or, you know, information out there about reverse mortgages. In this environment, what is your opinion on in reverse mortgages?
Good question. Reverse mortgages are for those that don't necessarily know what that is, it's being able to use the equity in real estate and be able to use that as you wish. Now, most people, when they want to use the equity that they have in their house, what their most options are what's most used is one of those cash-out refinancings. In other words, you're going to refinance your house for more than what you owe now, and the difference is going to be some cash they'll put in your pocket. Now, the cost of that normally is a higher interest rate on your loan. What is available now is what's called a reverse mortgage. So if you have equity in your house, and there's an equation to this that varies state to state, but based on your age and your circumstances, you can get what's called a reverse mortgage. In other words, you're going to give up the title to your house, and in return, they're going to pay you just like you're the bank. So instead of you making a mortgage payment, the bank's going to pay you a mortgage payment. Now, with that said, when we talk about reverse mortgages, I've never seen two that are the same. In other words, Once you see what your options are with the different lending companies, normally people are going to take a payout over a certain period of time. The way that reverse mortgages are, I guess, advertised or generally understood is that people think that I can get a check for as long as I live, and that's simply not the case. They're going to do a mathematical equation on what you have as far as equity, and they're going to guarantee you some rate of return on that equity over a period of time. The longer the period of time, the smaller your monthly payment will be. The shorter the period of time, the higher your payment will be. But at that end of that period of time, this bank or this lending institution does not want to own your property. So what they do is they sell it back to you or your estate. And that is their plan from the very beginning. So my point is, if you have equity in your house, you want to definitely look, and you need to use it, you want to look at all of your different options. This is the reverse mortgage is, from what we've seen here in my practice and over at the Lynn Group, with over 1,000 clients, would be this makes sense less of the time than a cash-out refi. Remember, on a reverse mortgage, you also have to be living in that house. So at any time, if you've got to move out, there's probably going to be language in that deal to where they're going to want to modify it. So I have to look at them on an individual basis. It's definitely something to consider. But where it sounds like the golden answer, many, many times it's not. And they're being used a lot less than they were. And also, Paula, you mentioned in this environment.
Yes.
Well, in this environment, mainly the biggest influences on your reverse mortgage numbers are going to be your property value. And depending on where you are in and I'm assuming in Texas, we're probably better off than in a lot of the other parts of the country. So in this environment, if we were living in a condo in Florida, I would say that this is probably a horrible time, because what you're doing is you're virtually selling your property to a lending institution, and then they're selling it back to you at some other period of time when it's probably going to be more expensive. So in other words, it'll be more expensive to your estate, or at the end of this period of time, you won't be able to afford the house and you'd have to move out. In most places in Texas and where we are here in Houston, we didn't take that kind of hit or that kind of markdown in our real estate prices. So if the price of your house or the appraisals on your house are maybe 5 or 10% lower than they were a few years ago, depending on your situation, it's probably not a bad time, or said differently, it probably isn't worth waiting for property values to get any higher. Where it concerns, where we talk about this environment and it has to do with the stock market, doesn't really have anything to do with what your reverse mortgage rates would be.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Paula. Good question.
Okay, I'm showing we have our next question. Comes from Mike.
Hello. I've got a question about, with the economic times like they are and the possibility of inflation and unemployment going up, what kind of investments would you say would be good? I mean, commodities, how do you feel about that? Or gold and silver, for example?
Good question, Mike. And that was in this environment, dealing with both the possibility of inflation and some other data that, you know, we're all familiar with, and that's unemployment. You know, where do we go? I mean, where do we invest? How do we position ourselves? And you probably aren't going to like my answer, because once again, it goes back to, you know, the actual individual. So, Mike, in your situation, let's say that we had enough money, in your opinion, to last you the rest of your life, as long as you had 5% return, and you could continue to contribute, say, $5,000 a year for the next 10 years. And then, according to your plan, you are all set. And you're, as far as risk tolerance, you have a ton of experience, and you handled very well emotionally and financially any big swings in the market. So the playing field would be wide open for me. All right, so I went through all of that just so that everybody can see that there's not an answer for this question unless I am talking to a specific individual with specific needs, specific goals, and the means to achieve those goals, which doesn't always mean just sitting on your investments and watching them hopefully grow. It also means, you know, saving and planning along those lines as well. So to address the inflation and the unemployment, there's a funny thing about inflation. You know, the government produces an inflation number for us measured by the Consumer Price Index. And the Consumer Price Index takes in account the value of all goods and services sold in the entire United States. Unfortunately, Mike, for me and you, we don't use all the goods and services of everything offered in the United States. So, Mike, you might spend 25% of your disposable income at the grocery store. I might spend 50% of my disposable income at the grocery store. But I don't know where you guys shop, but we're down at the end of my street, milk and bread are twice as much as they were 5 years ago. Well, that's a heck of an inflation rate. Okay, that's an inflation rate that, you know, breaches 20%. The government right now is telling us that we have an inflation rate that's almost zero. So it's costing me almost 100% more in groceries over the last 5 years. That's a heck of an inflation rate, but it's not being reflected necessarily in the investment world because that's not how they measure inflation. Now, with that said, because of the money that the government is spending, with the purpose of stimulating the economy, what in a sense we're doing is we're putting more money into the system to at least buy the same amount of goods and the same amount of services. Now, I'm not sure how much, you know, how many economic classes that you've had. I've just had a few. I've just been in the business for a while. But every book that I've read says that when you have more dollars chasing the same amount of goods or fewer goods, that you have inflation. It just makes sense that things need to get more expensive. If for anything else, it takes gasoline to deliver just about any goods and services to my house. And with the price of gas going up, you just got to think everything's going to get more expensive. But with all of that said, it's very hard for an individual to predict and then invest based on inflation because you have other outside influences. Right now, the government has a $700 billion spending program that's helping buy mortgage rates down. In other words, the government is spending $2 to $3 billion a day buying mortgages out on the open market from firms like mine and others across the country. What that has done is that's more dollars chasing the same amount of mortgages. It's driven the price really high and the rates really low so that we all can go out and refinance our house and so that some folks can go out and get a really good first mortgage rate. When the government stops that, we're going to see interest rates, especially on home mortgages, go up. And our prediction is if they stop today, we'd see at least a 1% move. In other words, if you can find a 5% now, they would overnight go to 6. So it's really hard to, I guess, over a long period of time, look at an entire plan and say, I'm going to plan for inflation. The only way that I could ever say that that plan is going to make a lot of sense long term is if I don't need to really make any more money to survive on what I have. In other words, I need a zero return to last the rest of my life. Well, now inflation does matter to me, because at a 3% inflation rate 20 years from now, everything that I spend is going to cost twice as much as it does today. So now I need to at least earn that inflation rate. I'll address unemployment in a second, but I guess where it comes to inflation, there's a lot of manipulation on what those overall rates are, and there's very few instruments that you can use to truly offset them. Where it comes to unemployment, I'm going to just go back to some of the bleakest times that we've had in the stock market in recent memory, going back to March of this year. As of March of this year, from its all-time high, the Dow Jones was down almost 50%. Today, we've had somewhat of a recovery. We're actually up almost, I guess, close to 30, 35% from those lows. But my point is, when it seemed the worst was the best time, actually, over the last two-year period of time to get into the market. So as we look at unemployment and we go forward thinking about if with high unemployment, we see that, you know, there's going to be other problems and, you know, possibly companies not doing well. Remember, an investment return doesn't have any feelings. An investment doesn't have any eyes, and it doesn't read the news. And what companies do in periods like this is they retool. You see the layoffs, they're scaling back and they're getting thinner on expenses, so they're getting leaner. And even with unemployment going up, we will see some of the biggest increases in returns on different companies than we have in a long time. So unemployment is not a good predictor of how I should invest defensively or aggressively. So kind of taking your whole question in this environment, including inflation and unemployment and everything else around us, how do I protect myself? We're going to go back to that goal setting and diversification. We're going to look at your overall goals, what your needs are, what we're trying to achieve, and what our means are to achieve those goals. Then we're going to take a portion of our diversification and prepare ourselves for things like this. What can we use? I think that was the real question. I talked for 5 minutes dancing around it. We can use things like some commodities and some futures contracts. But if you're a brand new investor, we should never talk about futures contracts. So that goes back to that suitability and risk tolerance area. We can use things like actual gold, putting gold coins in a safety deposit box. So it really depends on how expansive, if you will, your investments are, how many different asset classes that you're in now, and then can we move some of those into things that are going to not correlate, not have the similar return as the stocks will, as the bonds will. And sometimes that is commodities, and sometimes that's not. So I want to bring it all back to that plan again, Mike, and that if it's just you and I talking and, you know, we had the world open to us, it would involve some inflation hedging and some hedging for bad markets and bad times, but there's not any one instrument that's going to do it for you. It's going to be a combination of your entire portfolio.
Thank you.
Okay, at this time, I'm showing that there are no more questions.
I have another question. In a situation where someone has multiple goals at once, for example, saving for a new home, for kids' college, and retirement, how do you determine which of those goals you should focus on first?
So the question is, with multiple goals, where do you start? Yeah, where do you focus? And this is actually the easy one because, you know, going back to the beginning, is in order to be a successful investor, you have to have goals. And we're already assuming now if we have multiple goals that you've got the goals written down. The next step is then to prioritize them and then, you know, start putting your plan into action, or putting the plan together and then putting it into action. So We're talking about priorities. If you have three goals, and one of them is saving for retirement, one is buying a house, and the other one is putting a child to college, it really is going to depend on a few different factors, but it all boils down to what your priorities are. If, for example, you plan on working for the next 20 years and your child is going to college in the next 10 years, obviously that 10-year time horizon is going to be something that is something you're going to need to start working on sooner because it just gets more expensive later. But with that said, so does retirement. So it's going to be a balance between those different goals. So once again, we're going to go back to that individual, you know, and prioritizing what's more important to you and taking care of those things first. And I'll tell you, in our experience, what we find people doing is not taking care of themselves first. So if we look at three goals again, buying a house, putting a child through college, and retirement, at the end of the day, we don't know who's going to be there to take care of us. That should be the first dollar that you invest, and that is for yourself. Maybe something less important is the house, and I'm just guessing now because everybody's different, and then, you know, maybe something more important than the house is putting the child through college. But depending on your situation, that may be the most important thing there. So that would be where you'd want to concentrate most of your investing for. So it's really a matter of getting your goals down, like you said you had them down, right, Alicia?
Yeah.
And then putting a priority on them. And then we get into the time horizons and the different risk that we can take with each one of the goals in our plan.
Great, thank you. All right. Well, thank you so much, Mr. Lind. I really appreciate you spending your time with us this evening and giving us all of this great information. For the participants on the call, I will be sending you the PowerPoints and also another piece of literature that Mr. Lind has put together for us. So please expect an email from me here probably tomorrow or the day after. Thank you so much for joining us. Have a good evening.